Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect is Dennis Cawthorn. Dennis has many hats, but we're going to be talking to him about a book that he has written about Mackinac Island. It's called Mackinac Island Inside, Up Close, and Personal. Dennis's background, as you will hear, is intimately related to Mackinac, the island that I call Michigan's retreat house. Dennis Cawthorn, With Respect. Dennis, how are you this morning?
Well, I'm fine, John. Good to be with you.
Likewise. Now, Dennis, you and I have known each other for many years in politics and in other places around and Mackinac Island, because I keep seeing you up there, and we have a lot of mutual friends. But I got to tell you that the reason that we're doing this show is certainly not because of friendship, because you are a son of a gun. However, this book that you've written is absolutely fascinating. It's about you and Mackinac Island. It sounded like a marriage between the two of you. How did you first get in touch with Mackinac Island?
Well, I was a young college student. I was in my sophomore year at Albion College, having come there from my hometown of Manistee, and One spring evening, I think it was actually St. Patrick's Day, I was crossing campus with one of my fraternity brothers. He said, "Hey, what are you doing this summer for a job?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." Because in the previous summers, I'd worked in Washington, D.C. For a member of Congress and had fascinating experiences in Washington, but I was looking to do something different. And I said, "Well, I don't know what I'm going to be doing this summer." So he said, "Well, why don't you think about coming up to Mackinac Island?" He said, "I had a job there last summer working for the carriage company." And he said, "It was a great job. I loved it. Why don't you come up there?" Well, I had never been to Mackinac Island, even though I was born and raised in the Manistee area up north from where you are. And I thought, well, okay, I'll give it a shot. It's certainly different than Washington, D.C., but I'll give it a shot. So I went up there, and the rest is, as they say, history.
Well, let's start off with, yes, Manistee, and you went to Albion, but you also, unfortunately, probably, went to Harvard at some point.
Yes, I did. Actually, then after my 4 years at Albion and after a summer working on the island, yes, I entered Harvard Law School to begin 3 years of hard labor there, learning the intricacies of the law, and you know something about that.
Poor baby, poor baby. Now, if you had only gone to a good Midwestern law school, that would have been even better.
Well, anyway. I tried to inculcate the Midwestern values to the Harvard law community, but it didn't work so well.
All right. Well, let's bounce back to Mackinac Island just to give, if there's possibly anybody in our audience of millions of people who has not been or does not know of Mackinac Island, where is it and what is it?
Well, Mackinac is, I like to say, tucked between Michigan's upper and lower peninsula. It is, it actually lies in Lake Huron, but just a mile or two to the west is Lake Michigan. And the island is 2,211 acres. It's 8.3 miles in circumference. It's beautifully forested with just the purest blue waters you'll ever want to see, and with high and towering cliffs and some beautiful woodlands and a lot of beautiful Victorian mansions. It's just a glorious place to visit, highly picturesque, certainly deserving of an award made by a national magazine a few years ago, saying it was one of the, I think, three or four most beautiful islands in the world. And those of us who love it agree with that assessment. But it's a great place. And from the St. Joe area and then even the Chicago area, you know, it's not that far a drive. It would be, well, I don't know, I suppose about a five-mile drive. Well, you'd know that, John. You've driven it. But it's again, between our upper and lower peninsula, and just a great place for a getaway.
It is, but now it's not all fudge shops, which we're going to be talking about later, and history and buildings, but it's most of it is a state park.
That's right. 83% of the island is actually owned by the state of Michigan. It was and is Michigan's first state park. It originally was a national park. Believe it or not, it was the second national park, the first one being Yellowstone. However, the U.S. government in the 1890s, when it decided to abandon Fort Mackinac, decided to turn the National Park at Mackinac over to the state of Michigan. And the state of Michigan accepted it, and it became our first state park. And certainly it, I believe, is almost certainly is our largest state park, too, I might add. So 83% of the island is state park and governed by the state of Michigan.
Now, it's got a great and long and fascinating history as part of the growth of our country. It goes way back, that first settlements from after the Native Americans, and there's many, many different people in the Mackinac area that are full-blooded or partially related to the various tribes that have been in the area, right?
Yes, that's correct. The history of the island, at least as it relates to the Europeans, goes back way into the 1600s. In fact, a lot of people don't realize that St. Ignace and Sault Ste. Marie, both of which are very near the island, are the second oldest white settlements in the U.S. I think St. Augustine, Florida, is first. But the St. Ignace and Sioux areas were the second to be actually settled by Europeans. So the Straits of Mackinac, in which Mackinac Island is located, has had the presence of white settlers or visitors going back to the 1600s. And then, of course, the island was fought over between the English and the Americans, even after American independence. And you're right, John. The Native American presence in the Straits of Mackinac area has always been very strong, and remains so to this day.
Well, let's take you again. We've got this beautiful island, and you've got the opportunity to spend a summer up in Mackinac Island. Now, obviously, you did something very high level. You were probably president of the Grand Hotel or something, right?
It was very high level. It involved mainly driving a team of horses and mucking out the horses' stables in the morning and putting bits in the mouths of slobbering equines. So it was very high level. I soon discovered that I did not like that kind of work. I guess I've always been a white-collar guy. And the company agreed that I was probably better suited doing something other than trying to personally throw harnesses on these beasts and then drive them. So they promoted me to the lofty position of what we call the street man, and my job was to lure urge and otherwise encourage people to take the carriage, the hour and a half carriage tour of the island. And in that capacity, I met a lot of people from the local community, and that really sort of started me off on my island journey.
Well, it sounds like you could have just gone from there to, say, Times Square. Back in the day, and kind of hook people into places of ill repute.
Well, we could have done that, but we didn't.
All right, okay. However, you were obviously a better talker than you were a bit putter in her, whatever.
That's right, and so in that capacity, standing on the main street of Mackinac, I first became acquainted with the array of very colorful characters who inhabited and still inhabit the island. And you know, one of the themes in my book is that Mackinac is the place of some highly colorful, highly interesting people. And in fact, in the book we say, and if I can just quote for a minute, we quote a summer cottager who said that Mackinac Island breeds the most interesting, cantankerous, curious, brazen, strange, likable manhood and womanhood known to Western man and maybe beyond. He continued, you know, this 8-mile around island boasts a cast of characters that would make even Charles Dickens, the great Victorian chronicler, green with envy. These are not characters you see in everyday suburban America. And that was the thing that really fascinated me about the island. Now, I will say that I think the array of colorful characters is not quite as broad as it was when I first came there in 1960, but there still are a lot of them, and that's one of the great attractions of the island. And that's really a lot of what this book is about, are the people. So this is my book is less one about the history or the architecture or the fudge shops. It's more about the people and what really moves and shakes and makes the island the highly special and a highly unusual place that it is.
You know, one of the a part of your book that you didn't quote, but I got a real bang out of this, is the some of the names that people have. I'm looking at one part in which you identify people like Yunk Yunk and Bum and Bam and Eagle Eye and Beaver and Fats and Snappy, Snapper, Porky, Skeezix, Weenix, Gunny, Cornflakes.
and those were names that people literally were known by those names. In other words, it wasn't John Smetanka. It was like Snapper, or it was Cornflakes. That is how they were always known. And as a matter of fact, one of my great regrets is I had a great photo that in my personal collection that I could not find at the critical time when this book was being put together by me. It was a photo of Yunk Yunk, who was dressed in Native American costume because he was Native American. And he was in full Native American costume standing next to a very modern, sleek airplane at the dedication of the Mackinac Island Airport some years ago. It was such a great juxtaposition of the past and the present and almost the future. And to this day, I ransack through my house still trying to find that photo, which I know is here somewhere, because it would have been just a beautiful addition to the book.
Well, the book itself, we're going to get back into your experiences there, but the book itself is laden with a number of pictures of people that you knew, met, or had, who were movers and shakers in the Mackinac Island culture. But this book is not your ordinary picture book. Look at Myrtle. There's Picture Rock, or there is the Grand Hotel, and here is the beautiful sunset. It's all that, maybe, but it's very people-oriented, the fascinating people that move through, that live there year-round or came in this different odd times. So my question then is there a person, one person, that sticks out as the most unusual fellow or woman that you met? And I'm going to take a break now, and we're going to come back. I'm going to give you just a few seconds to pull that back from your memory. We're talking to Dennis Cawthorn, the author of a book called Mackinac Island, Inside, Up Close, and Personal. Great book, most enjoyable, just out. And this is John Smetanka on With Respect. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Dennis Cawthorn, the author of the book Mackinac Island, Inside, Up Close, and Personal. Dennis is a modest fellow. We're going to be talking about his later background later on. But, Dennis, I led into this questioning you about who is the most interesting character, if you could pick one, that you ran across in your many years on Mackinac Island.
Well, John, there's a really good question, and I have to say that I don't know that I can name one, but I will give you two or three. I'll cheat a little bit and say that there certainly are two or three who stood out. And in fact, in the book, we do have a chapter called "Three to Remember," I believe it is the title of that chapter. The one who was most influential, if that's the right word, with me, was a guy by the name of Jack Chambers. Jack Chambers was the guy that I first came to work for on the island, and he was really a legendary character at that time, and his legend still lives on. He was the assistant general manager of the Carriage Tours Company when I first went to work there. He was witty. He was acerbic. He was highly quotable. Whenever the media came to the island to do a story on the place, they would always seek him out because he was always good for some great and hilarious quotes. He liked to stir the political pot. In later years, he became. He would utter things that were not PC, were not politically correct, but nevertheless, he was a colorful character, very conservative in his political views, I might add, and he served many functions on the island. He was on the board of public works. He was the city building inspector. He was the city supervisor, all unpaid jobs, by the way. And he was a prodigious beer drinker, even though he was totally dry for the first 35 years of his life. But if you wanted a colorful character who always had a colorful quip at hand, it was Jack Chambers. Then there was another one who remains a legend on the island to this day. His name was Louis DeRocha, popularly known as Louis the Thief. Louis had been a used car salesman in Sheboygan and came to the island and opened a place called Louis Drive-In, which was actually Louis Horse and Buggy Drive-In. And if you wanted a hamburger or a Coke, whatever, you went to Louis Drive-In. And one time he was asked, "Louis, is it true that your hamburger is actually consists of horse meat?" And he had a one-word reply. He said, "Nay." And I had a third one I'll just throw out was a highly influential politician, Wilfred Francis Xavier Bill Doyle. Bill Doyle had been a member of the state Senate for one term back in the 1930s. He became highly attached to the island, served in the State Park Commission for over 40 years, and was had a very sly wit. He was a quintessential Irishman, and he was a political mover and shaker who loved to stir things up and loved political controversy and wasn't afraid to mix it up with such people as former Governor Soapy Williams. So those are three: Louis the Thief, Bill Doyle, Jack Chambers, and certainly Harry Reiba of the Fudge Empire would also rank as one of the most colorful.
Well, now you've mentioned four people now, but I noticed different sort of ethnic backgrounds to each of these people. Mm-hmm. There are at least three or four groups, ethnic groups that formed part of the old people, the old groups in Mackinac Island, and it sounds like they were the Indians, the French, and the Irish. Is that accurate?
Yes, the island's history, and was certainly more pronounced when I first came there, but it still is still very much in existence. The island's ethnic mix was and is French Indian and Irish. The Irish came onto the island primarily by way of Beaver Island. They had left Ireland during the so-called potato famine, and many of them, for some reason, ended up on Beaver Island, and then subsequently migrated to Mackinac. And so the early European settlers were almost exclusively Irish. The Dowds, the Chambers, Flanagans, Corrigans, you can go right on down, Murrays, right down the list of great Irish names, and many of those Irish families are still there and very conscious of their Irish ethnicity. And then the other group, as you say, were the French Indians. And as I say in the book, one of the things that always kind of mystified me was why, even though the English were certainly prominent in the area, manning the fort and so forth, why the English never intermarried with the local Native American population. The French did, and the result is that on Mackinac there's a very heavy component of French Indian ethnicity, and that's true in the St. Ignace area also. So the French Indians and the Irish are both still very prominent in the ethnic and cultural makeup of the island.
You know, it's interesting. I'm going to do a slight digression. That is, some friends of mine from England have a fascinating, Julia had a very fascinating background just in those areas. She was a Somerset, that is, from the Duke of Somerset family. But she then, I was checking, she was telling me her background. Her ancestors included Joseph Brant, who was the head of the six civilized tribes of the Iroquois during the time of the American Revolution, whose daughter married, I think, Sir William Johnson, who was a commander of the British forces. So there is a Native American part of her family, but also she was descended from another side, from Charles Stuart Parnell, who was an Irish revolutionary in the late 1800s.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so fascinating background that, once again, you know, you talk about the British not intermarrying, not intermingling, but sometimes they did. But at any rate, moving on, you talk about people, and people also have to be tied into the places and the institutions to some extent. And, of course, the one big institution that everybody pays attention to when they think of Mackinac Island is the Grand Hotel. And they had, that institution had a tremendous number of interesting people floating in and around its existence.
Yes, and of course, the person who was dominant at Grand Hotel for so many years was W. Stuart Woodfill. Stuart Woodfill wintered across the lake from the Berrien County area. He wintered and had his winter offices in the Chicago area. Grand Hotel's winter offices were in the Chicago area for many, many years. So W. Stuart Woodfill was the dominant person at Grand Hotel, and he had started there as a young man, as a desk clerk. And then in the 1920s, he managed to scrape together some money and, along with a couple of other fellows, bought Grand Hotel. But the partnership didn't work out so well, and so he withdrew from the partnership. Well, along came the Great Depression of the 1930s. And the Grand Hotel, as well as many other businesses, sunk into economic collapse. And the hotel went into receivership. It was put up for bid. Only one person made a bid. I don't know what it was, but I can tell you that it was very, very, very little. And that one person was W. Stuart Woodfill. And so W. Stuart Woodfill then became owner of Grand Hotel in 1933. And he spent the next, approximately 45 years as the dominant figure at Grand Hotel. And then when he prepared to retire in the late 1970s, he sold the hotel to his nephew, Dan Musser, who then became the owner and operated for many, many years. He just passed away about a year and a half ago. And, of course, Dan Musser III is now the owner and the chief executive of Grant Hotel. But Stuart Woodfill was a towering figure in his time.
Well, they were powerful figures. I knew Dan Musser very well, and I know his son, but never met Stuart Woodfill. But I know that in your book you talk about this man believed not only in the Grand Hotel but also in Mackinac Island was a powerful force in bringing it along.
Yes, and one of the first of all, he was a master of PR. He knew how to stoke PR juices. For example, he convinced Robert Ripley. Maybe you remember, maybe your listeners remember Ripley's "Believe It or Not" column in the newspapers.
I do.
And so he convinced Robert Ripley to run a piece, and this is sort of done by cartoon figures, the Ripley stuff, and in the piece it said the Grand Hotel had the world's longest porch at 880 feet. Well, Grand Hotel perhaps did and still does have the world's longest front porch, but it's only 660 feet. But he convinced Ripley, and to this day, legend says 880, but I can tell you, if you take out a yardstick, it's 660. But that was the sort of thing that Stuart Woodfill was very capable of doing. And in the summer that I came to the island, he was featured in Saturday Evening Post, which, of course, was the nation's premier magazine at a time when magazines were a very big thing on the American scene. And so Stuart Woodfill was featured in Saturday Evening Post, featured in many, many publications. But he also was a strong advocate for the construction of the bridge at the Straits of Mackinac. He saw that as being an important part of northern Michigan's economic development. And, of course, you know, the story of the bridge is a story unto itself, but suffice to say that it was thought for a long time impossible to bridge the Straits. Well, Stuart Woodfill was among those who championed the cause, and the bridge was built against great odds, finally opening on November 1st, 1957, contrary to an error that I made in the book, saying it was 58.
Well, now, Stuart Woodfill and the Mussers, Dan Musser, who mm-hmm. succeeded him, also contributed. They were not miserly people and just holding off to themselves. They were part of the community, weren't they?
Very much so, particularly with the Musser family. I will say that they have been very generous to the community. You know, in fact, just yesterday I got in the mail an invitation to the annual Island Appreciation Night, which Grant holds every year, just about their closing time. And Grant Hotel invites, virtually everyone on the island who's made any kind of contribution to the community. And by contribution, I mean not just money. I'm talking about labor, a fireman, for example. Anybody who's made any kind of contribution to the community is invited every year to Grant Hotel for sort of a season-closing party. And Grant's been very generous, underwriting many, many community events. So we give the Mussers a great deal of credit, both Dan Sr., who, as I say, has passed away, and Dan Jr., the current president. Both have always been very generous to the community.
One of the other startling eminence grees, so to speak, overlooking the whole village is the fort, Fort Mackinac. And that is, as you come in on the ferries, of which we'll talk later, you come in and you see this brooding presence over the top, and they fire cannons, and they have tours in which muskets are fired and whatnot. It's a great, interesting, very interesting historical part of the island. But that was that also played a big part in things like names of the parts of the island, British Landing. There was a reason for it being called British Landing, wasn't there?
Yes. First of all, just a comment on the fort. Interestingly enough, it was actually many of the materials of Fort Mackinac were contained in the fort at Mackinac City, and and were hauled over on the ice when the British decided to decamp from Mackinac City and build the fort at Mackinac. They literally dismantled a large sections of the fort in Mackinac City and came and hauled it across the ice in the winter to create the fort on the island. That was a massive undertaking, obviously. But British Landing got its name when the British came ashore to surprise the Americans, who at the time held Fort Mackinac. There was a surprise attack at a place on the northwest side of the island called British Landing, or the northwest side, in that place of attack became known as British Landing, because obviously the British landed there, marched up a road from the northwest end of the island to a height overlooking the fort, and demanded the surrender by the Americans, which the Americans had to do because they were in a hopeless position with the British being now ensconced over them and looking down. And so the Americans only got the fort back through a treaty of peace, the Treaty of Ghent, signed in Belgium in 1815, was the means by which the Americans got the fort back from the British. We never won it back militarily. We had to do it through treaty.
Through those wily negotiators over in Ghent.
Yes.
We're going to take a break now again. We're talking to Dennis Cawthorn, who's the author of the new book, Mackinac Island, Inside, Up Close, and Personal. We've been talking to Dennis about the people, the history, the building. We're going to talk later about some of the events that have been going on. But right now, we'll take a break. This is John Smetanka. The name of our program is With Respect. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with the author of the book Mackinac Island, Up Close, Inside, Up Close and Personal, Dennis Cawthorn. This is John Smetanka. Dennis, when we broke, we were talking about the fort itself, Fort Mackinac, and it at one point was a pretty important place on the Great Lakes. And a lot of interesting things. One medical discovery, as I recall, occurred there during one of those long, bitter winters. Isn't there something about a musket and a doctor?
Oh, John, you've got a good memory. Yes, Dr. William Beaumont was assigned to Fort Mackinac, and in the course of his duties, he was called to the assistance of a young man, Alex St. Martin, or St. Martin, who had been shot and shot in the stomach, and Dr. Beaumont was called to provide medical assistance. Well, over a period of time, he discovered that through some fluke of healing, he was able to actually observe the workings of St. Martin's stomach. He was able to actually see the stomach do its work of digestion. And as a result, Beaumont recorded his observations, and these became very, very famous. They became very important in the study of medicine. And consequently, Beaumont found his way into the pages of medical history and medical fame. And in the Detroit area, there's a major hospital system, Beaumont Hospital, named after Dr. Beaumont. And so, yes, the fort is connected with that important piece of medical history, the observation of the gastric processes.
Now, one other place that I want to talk about is it's tied to a group of people. It is now called, I think, a Mission Point. which is not the Grand Hotel, but it's north, or I'm sorry, it's east of the Grand Hotel, east of the village, called Mission Point Resort. But it was originally a religious or a sort of a quasi-religious group that was located there and built it up, wasn't it?
Yes, the story of moral rearmament and its presence on Mackinac is really a fascinating one, and we devote one of our longer chapters to it. Moral rearmament was founded by a Pennsylvania minister by the name of Frank Buchman, and it had its greatest growth in England during the 1920s, and Dr. Buchman traveled kind of over the world gaining converts to his movement, which basically had the theme of it's not who is right, but what is right. The further theme being that absolute honesty, absolute purity, and two other absolutes were the key to revitalizing society and bringing about peace in the world. Well, the movement gained great strength and great popularity prior to World War II. And then at the outbreak of the war, Frank Buchman was traveling in Michigan and met Henry Ford. And he commented to Henry Ford that what moral rearmament my organization needs now is a permanent home. We need a factory for our ideas and our movement. He was appealing to Henry Ford's manufacturing side when Buchman talked about the need for a factory for our movement. Henry Ford then picked up the phone and talked to the governor of Michigan at that time, Murray Pat Van Wagner, and indicated to him that Buchman was interested in finding a headquarters for his world movement in Michigan. And the idea then came forward that Mackinac Island, which was then in an economic slump because of the war, would be a perfect place, and the Island House Hotel on the island would be a perfect headquarters for moral rearmament. Well, in 1942, then after those conversations, moral rearmament came to the island, took over the Island House Hotel on a lease from the state, and this became the world headquarters of MRA. Well, when the war ended, moral rearmament was bigger and stronger than ever, and they had outgrown the Island House and therefore began buying up property at the east end of the island, and soon began to construct some fantastic facilities, including the greatest movie-producing sound stage in the world, right there at the east end of Mackinac Island. And before long, the entire east end of the island was owned by moral rearmament, and those included old Victorian homes as well as all the new great buildings that MRA constructed at that point.
Well, some of our listeners may be old enough to remember the program that came out of that famous soundstage. Was it the Young Americans?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, the Young Americans were the ones who were also known as the Up With People movement. And Up With People was a very popular young person's movement, which was actually sponsored by moral rearmament. But the fascinating thing about MRA, as we say in the book, is that it brought to Mackinac Island leaders from all over the world. And so here in this sleepy northern Michigan island town, there was suddenly infused the presence of literally hundreds of people, some wearing flowing robes, turbans, kilts, all sorts of native dress from all over the world, and suddenly this a very insular community in every respect was infused with people from all over the world, and it created a great deal of tension. At first, their presence was welcome because it was a true economic shot in the arm for the island, because jobs were needed and tourism was needed, But when their presence had been there for a period of time, great tensions flared, and the last years of MRA on the island was marked by great controversy and great bitterness between the community and MRA.
One of the things that I have heard in my trips to the island, and because of Prosecuting Attorneys Association conventions, I went there for many years, every year, for a few days, and got to love every single minute of it. But one of the mysteries is there really a bomb shelter built underneath the Moral Rearmament area?
I am not aware that there is. I rather doubt it. What was built, however, and we mentioned this in the book, is a tall observation tower, which, by the way, is presently open to the public. If one goes down to Mission Point Resort, you can pay a small admission fee and go up into the observation tower. The observation tower was built by MRA, and at the time in the community, the rumor was so that MRA could spy on the local population, many of whom they regarded as persons who were inimical to their four absolutes of honesty, purity, et cetera, et cetera. So that was built, but I've never heard about a bomb shelter. But there was, as I say, great animosity. Although they had their adherence to the community. Not everyone was anti-MRA, but many, many people were. And then ultimately, MRA had three world headquarters: Coe, Switzerland, Tokyo, and Mackinac Island. But in the early 1970s, moral rearmament essentially collapsed on the island, and they were forced to convert the property into a college, the first Mackinac College. But that didn't last very long. It lasted for 4 years. There was only one graduating class. Now, Moral Rearmament still exists, by the way, and their headquarters are in Coe, Switzerland, I believe. But the Mackinac presence now is a thing of history.
Well, this has been, that part of it is fascinating. But any other person coming to the island is struck by two things which we haven't talked about. One is the village. The village itself, with all the various shops and tourist locations, is fascinating. And the other is the Victorian homes on the East and West Bluff. Let's talk about those homes first. There's some very prominent, interesting people who have built homes over the years and lived there, and some of them still live there today. And I think you do, but not on the Bluff.
Yes, I do have a home, actually two of them, on the island, but I'm not on the Bluff. But those spectacular Victorian cottages, they're called, but others would call them mansions. Those spectacular residences on the Bluff are certainly showpieces in and of themselves. And they've been preserved very, very carefully over the years. And they've been preserved at least for one reason, because the State Park Commission, which owns the land under which these cottages sit, has certain rules and regulations so that these cottages must be preserved according to national historic guidelines. But they are beautiful, and people who come to the island have a chance to walk right by them and take in all their spectacular detail. They're not only beautiful cottages, but as you know, they have spectacular views because they're high in the bluffs, the so-called East Bluff and West Bluff, and they are just gorgeous places.
My recollection is that one of those was Soapy Williams' summer home.
That's correct. It was, and it's now owned by the Manoogian Foundation, and is used for a number of community and other events, and is a beautiful, beautiful piece of property.
Well, there is one other mansion I wanted to talk about, and then we're going to move to the village, and that is the governor's mansion, the summer mansion. That's a fascinating history, and it's a great, talk about a great view.
Yes, the governor's residence is really a spectacular place. It was built in 1902 for, I believe, $18,000. I may be off a few bucks here or there. Built in 1902, primarily of white pine, and was used by the several families. And then in 1944, Bill Doyle, who I had mentioned him earlier as one of the three fascinating people, Bill Doyle led an effort to convince the Michigan legislature to acquire that home to use it as a residence for the governor of Michigan. Unlike other states, the Michigan governor did not have a residence. In most states, as you know, the governor has a residence in the state capital city. Well, Michigan did not have one, but Bill Doyle came up with the idea of acquiring the residence on the island for a summer home for Michigan's governor. And he said to the legislature, you should do this because in 1945, we are host to the National Governors Conference, and wouldn't it be nice to have this spectacular home for our governor to be a showpiece and a centerpiece of the National Governors Conference. So the legislature agreed to buy the property and did so for $18,000, the exact price that was that it cost to build it in 1902. And so the state came into the ownership of the residence. It's actually owned by and deeded to the State Park Commission, who in turn designated as use to be used by the governor. So that's been the residence of our governor, and was the only residence of our governor until early 1970s, when a residence was acquired also in Lansing. So now the Michigan governor has two residences, but Mackinac was the first one and the only one for a long time.
We're going to take another break now. We're talking to Dennis Cawthorn, the author of Mackinac Island, Inside, Up Close, and Personal. This is John Smetanka. We're talking on With Respect. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Dennis Cawthorn, the author of Mackinac Island, Inside, Up Close, and Personal. This is John Smetanka. Dennis, when we broke, we had talked about, we'd sort of circled the island and talked about the various things and the people and the history and whatnot. The village itself, which is what everybody sees when they first come onto the island on the ferries, is not just a picture book sort of place, i.e. they didn't just put all those interesting buildings up for the TV cameras, but rather those buildings have been there for a long time.
Yes, many of the buildings on the main street date back to mid-1800s. There is at least one building downtown that dates back to the 1780s, the Mustang Lounge, a bar and restaurant on the island. Parts of it date back, we believe, to the 1780s, and most of downtown does date back certainly to the mid or latter part of the 1880s. And again, there are restrictions on what you can do with those buildings, although for a long time there were not restrictions on the facade and character of the buildings. And yes, downtown is primarily located within the city, which is to say that Mackinac Island is incorporated as a city. It's not a home rule city, though. It's now the only city in the state of Michigan which is a so-called special act city. We don't have home rule. Our charter was written by the legislature in 1898, and that charter remains intact as written by the legislature then. And so there's a mayor and a council that govern the island, but they govern, as we point out in the book, actually only 17% of the island's land area. The ordinances that apply in the state park don't apply in the city, and those in the city don't apply in the state park. And this gets very confusing because the city is not just one compact 17% area. If you get on your bike and ride around the perimeter of the island, you will go in and out of the city and the state park about 10 times. So depending on where you are, it depends on what rules govern. And so it makes for some interesting times.
Back when I was young and feisty and healthy, we used to have a run around the island at the prosecutor's conference. So several times I did the full 8.3 miles of running. And the last time, after about 10 of these, the last time I ended up about 6 miles around, I got tired. I said, why am I doing this? So I just went off into the lake and went for a swim. And because I took so long, they sent out a search party to make sure I had not died out there. Because at that time, I think I was the president of the association. It wouldn't have looked good to have that happen.
No, absolutely not.
All right. Dennis, there's so much more to talk about. But I want to tease the audience with some of the fascinating things that you talk about in the book that we actually haven't talked about. There was a murder on the island. And an unsolved murder, which goes back many years, and up near where you lived.
That's correct. It occurred in the first year that I was there, although I can assure you there was no direct connection. the murder has always been fascinating for this reason.
By the way, that's what they all say when
I know.
It was
As a prosecutor, you would know.
Other person did it. Okay, go ahead.
What was fascinating about it is this, that the murder occurred in broad daylight, on a late Sunday morning in July, at the height of the tourist season, and in particular during the Chicago to Mackinac yacht races, on the main road circling the island where thousands of people during that day would pass. And how this murder could have been perpetrated without the perpetrator ever being identified, found, or convicted is kind of an amazing thing. Just think about it. Broad daylight, Sunday morning, July, on a main road. It's actually a state highway. And yet, the strangler of the 49-year-old Dearborn widow or widow was never identified. And we talk about some of the fascinating aspects of the search for the killer, the presence of the bloodhounds baying down the boardwalk, the all-night vigil by the body, and various theories as to who did it and how they got away. But the bottom line is, to this day, no one knows who did it. It is one of Michigan's great unsolved crimes.
In addition to that, there's a number of other fascinating things about, for example, when you get on the island, you have to get there by boat. Or you can fly in, but for those
of
the rest
swim.
Of us.
You can swim. That's been done a couple of times.
Oh, really? All right. Mm-hmm. Well, I dreamed of that back in the day when I was when I was running, but I didn't think, no, I don't think that's a good idea. But they had ferry wars. They've got 3 or 4 or 5 different ferry companies that have come and gone over the years, and they were and still are in competition with one another.
Yes, and there is a relatively long chapter in the book, although all my chapters are fairly short, but there's a relatively long one called The Great Ferry Wars, 2011 to 2014. In a sense, they're still going on. What happened was, well, first of all, the ferry lines have always been highly competitive. Although Arnold Transit was the dominant carrier for many years, Arnold Transit was organized in 1878, and for many, many years was by far the dominant carrier, and also Mackinac Island's sort of hometown favorite because it was operated primarily out of Mackinac Island and was regarded as the hometown company. Well, in 2011, Arnold Transit was sold, and that touched off a major new era with major conflicts. In the most recent years, two new ferry lines had emerged, one being Shepler's. Shepler's had started as a very small operation in 1945, and by 2011 had become a very, very strong competitor with outstanding service. Star Line was another a company, fairly new to the scene, but very aggressive and had a fine reputation also. When Arnold Line was sold in 2011, it opened up a whole new era. The new owners took on a huge debt and had huge carrying costs. The result was that they quickly became financially troubled. And the city council earlier had been under some pressure to try to bring about some consolidation of the lines because it was felt that the three lines was really too many and that the prices were higher than they needed to be. If you had a more efficient system, it would be good. So the city was interested in bringing about, in a sense, less competition. But then when Arnold Line ran into financial troubles, all that fell apart. And because there was a concern that the city was seeking to maybe create less competition, one of the companies went to the legislature, sought legislation that would greatly alter the scene. This touched off all sorts of legal and political wars, and in a sense, those are still kind of still going on. The fate of Arnold Line right now is very uncertain. Shepler's and Star have benefited greatly from Arnold's weakened condition, and it remains to be seen whether there will be three lines operating in 2015.
Another area which we're going to have to come to a close, unfortunately. We could talk all day about this book and your experiences, but there's a political dimension here, and that you've talked several times about the State Park Commission, and now I'll shorten this by saying the position of Mackinac State Park Commission, and especially the chairman's position, is probably the premier political plum for the state of Michigan. It's a great place. You have great places to have meetings and whatnot. And so you were the chairman of that commission for many years, and its life, that commission, basically has caused Mackinac to thrive or resolve problems or sometimes even created them. And you were a part of that. You were a state legislator for, 11 years?
12 years. Yep.
12 years. Mm-hmm. And you were down in the Manistee, Muskegon area. Mm-hmm. But then, as I say, you had this world as the chairman of the State Park Commission. And the interaction between the commission, the political figures of the state of Michigan and around the country, presidents came and went, famous people of Vandenberg. There was a conference, a special conference after the Second World War in which interesting and important policies were described and created and begun to implement. This place truly is a remarkable, remarkable place from all different kinds of aspects. People, events, the physical island, the politics going in, and as I say, the people are perhaps even the most interesting. Dennis, I toss those items out because they are found in greater detail and in great, great fun reading in your book. I congratulate you for a really fascinating read.
Well, thank you, John. And let me just say to your listeners that I encourage them, if they're interested in this book, and I do think they will love it, to go to their local bookstore and ask for Mackinac Island Inside, Up Close and Personal. And if they can't get it there or don't choose to get it there, it is available from Amazon. And I know a lot of people have purchased it through Amazon. And again, you can use some, I think, to find it also my last name, which is, as I used to say when I was in politics, like Hawthorne, only with a C, Cawthorne. So there is a way, I think, for your listeners to get it, and I think they would really enjoy it.
Great. All right. The name of the book is Mackinac Island Inside, Up Close and Personal, and our guest has been Dennis Cawthorne, the author and a major figure in the history of Mackinac Island. Fascinating, interesting. I can't promote books other than to say I really enjoyed this book. The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. And until next time, remember, our mantra is, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.